Good.
Well, there we go. Why don't you begin by telling me a little bit about yourself?
Yes, well, so I live in the Netherlands. I'm 26 years old, and I live in the town of Kampen. So that's because I study here at the Theological University. I got married last year. My husband also studies at the university, but he's studying to become a pastor, and I'm just mostly interested in the academic side.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes. So, yeah, where should I begin?
Anywhere you want. Were you raised in a Christian home?
I wasn't. So, or at least I would say that I wasn't, I do not consider myself as coming from a Christian home. My parents got divorced when I was 7. And after that, they stopped visiting church. And before that, it was also mostly just going through the rhythm, going through the motions, let's say.
Yeah.
So
it's not unusual in a divorce. Church often gets the axe, at least in the first few years after the divorce.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly what happened. So they weren't, the church wasn't, I don't think they were really nasty about the divorce, but they didn't really approve of it either.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's just what happened. And well, my mom, she kept a kind of a mixed blend of spirituality, a little bit of Christianity, a bit of Eastern spirituality and occultism. And well, that's actually kind of what drew me towards atheism, mostly because I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I was quite afraid of ghosts and stuff. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you certainly didn't stay there. What happened?
Well, what happened is when I was 16, I had a bit of a difficult childhood, of course, because of the divorce and all the adjustments that took. I got into a relationship with a man that was quite a bit older than me. And I moved into his house when I was 18, and he had all kinds of issues. Like depression and mental illness, and he couldn't work. So we had a very difficult time. And at some point, I realized that it wasn't going to get any better. And then I kind of tuned out of the relationship and tuned into gaming. And yeah. So what happened was I got into this online community with into this multiplayer zombie game. And there was a man there, and he was genuinely interested in other people. He seemed to care. He was intelligent, and we talked a lot, but he had very strange opinions, at least I thought so, on topics like homosexuality and divorce. And I just couldn't figure out what was up with the man. So then I asked him, and he said, "Well, I'm a Christian." I was like, "Well, who's a Christian? I mean, that's stupid. Maybe I can help you, you know, like to become an atheist." But then I don't know exactly. I don't remember how exactly it went, but I think he at some point made clear that I should give it a chance before I start critiquing it. And I actually thought, oh, well, that's a fair point. I actually never really did give it a chance. So I started reading the Gospels, and I just believed what they said. And I still, to this day, can't explain why, because it rationally, I just couldn't compute it. But then I don't know, for some reason, I just believed that God existed. And then I had a problem, of course, because what should I do? So what happened at that moment was that I got thrown out by my boyfriend, which wasn't a negative thing per se. I was actually quite happy that was the way things were turning out. And so I moved out, and then and I had to find a church, because I was doing research online, and I came across all these sermons and all these pastors saying, "You need to go to church, you need to go to church." And I had no idea. I'd never been to a church as an adult. So I remember that my manager at my workplace, he went to church. So I went and approached him and I said, well, there's this thing, this weird thing has happened, and I think that God exists, and I read everywhere that I should go to church, so can you help me? And he did. And that was actually, it was such an amazing experience, because the church I went to, the pastor was very spiritually tuned in, and he's still a great friend of mine. And the people were very welcoming, and it was not at all what I thought church was when I wasn't a Christian. And how I ended up eventually going into seminary was that I, at some point, I realized that the Gospels were talking about Jesus and not about God. And it's, I didn't think that was possible, that the Gospels, you know, of course they are about Jesus, but I had heard them all the time just speaking about God. So I was introduced to a concept of the Trinity, because Jesus is part of the Trinity. And I had no idea what to do with that, because it's, well, it's not a logical thing. And then I stumbled upon the 5 theological orations by Gregory Nazianzen. And that's the first theological treatise I've ever read. And that's just, I immediately thought, I want more of that. This is so good. And so that is why I ended up going to seminary. And that's where I'm at right now.
Met your husband?
Sorry?
Did you meet your husband at seminary then?
Yes, I did. Yes. We accidentally lived together before we got into a relationship, because he lived in a student housing and I moved into the same student house. So, yes.
Wow. So what specifically are you studying in seminary? What's your focus?
I'm a bit too spread out at the moment with my focus. So when I started seminary, it was just Reformed theology. And that didn't appeal to me at all, because they don't read church fathers except Augustine. And I just never really liked Augustine. So that was a bit of a problem. But my husband, he's a great guy. He introduced me to people like Jordan Peterson and Jonathan Pageau, and you, of course. So you guys, you have helped me get through seminary just by keeping theology fun. Yes.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Last year, I thought I should do something about this, because I'm not going to, spiritually, it wasn't going very well for me. And I needed to do something. So I did 2 things. I started taking classes in philosophy. And that helped tremendously, because I had no idea that philosophy influenced theology so much.
Yeah, it
does. And I finally started making sense to me what I was doing in my studies in theology. And I took a minor in Orthodox Christianity. Okay. And that also changed things quite a bit, because they do read the church fathers.
Yeah, they do.
So yeah, life has changed in the past year.
Wow. Wow. You got married last year. You've been living a whirlwind.
Yes.
So where's this all going?
I'm not sure, actually. It's kind of what I'm wondering about right now.
Yeah. Well, you're married, so you've got some of these footings now. So whatever comes, you know, you have some pieces of it that are coming in. Well, what grabbed you about the church fathers?
Well, for one thing, the way they write, it's actually very accessible. So it's on a level, it's very deep and it's very spiritual, but it's also anyone, I think, can read them and understand where they're going. So at least if you have a decent translation, of course, because translations can mess things up. But you don't need to have vocabulary in mind with all the terminology they use, and it's not like a science exactly what they're doing.
Okay.
And that really appeals to me, and it's always about God, and that is, it's so strange that we can do theology without constantly talking about the relationship with God, because that was why I started, you know, liking the subject.
Yes. Oh, that's fascinating. Well, what's on your mind? What did you want to talk to me about?
I wanted to talk about like the dissonance between doing a bit more orthodox theology in my studies and finding that it's good for my spiritual life, but then not going to an orthodox church and actually not going to church at all, very much because of COVID, but also just because it just didn't speak to me anymore. Maybe it's a bit of a rebellious move to not go to church that often anymore, and struggling with these actually theological issues, like, for example, my church denomination, they see the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper as more like Zwinglian, in the sense that it's just a sign and there's no real presence. And then I think, well, that's not at least the way I think it should be. And not all Reformed churches subscribe to that, but my local church does. And then I think, well, it's, on the one hand, it's dishonest of me if I prescribe to another doctrine and still take the Lord's Supper. But if I don't do it, then people will start questioning, like, is there something wrong? And I don't know if that's something I'm struggling with right now.
I could imagine. This stuff is so hard. Well, you might think about the Lord's Supper and participation in it in a local church in a way analogous to how baptism is treated. So in the Christian Reformed Church, which is, you know, this, you probably know a little bit of Dutch history now, mm-hmm. in terms of church history. So the Christian Reformed Church is an offshoot of the, I'm probably butchering the Dutch pronunciation, but of the Afskeiding, which is this break in the, you know, in the, I think it was 1834, where de Kock, a lot of that schism was sort of an urban-rural schism. Mm-hmm. And so you had the Afskeiding, and then of course you had the Doleance with Abram Kuyper. So that mm-hmm. created this Christian Reformed Church that was fairly small in the Netherlands, but the emigration pattern to the United States was predominantly from those groups. And so that made the Christian Reformed Church, at least at the beginning of the 20th century, two or three times larger than the transplantation of the state church, which was the Reformed Church of America. So the Christian Reformed Church was a fairly conservative split off of the state church, but even so, it would, along with many other Christian churches, recognize baptisms done in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Now, that's very interesting because especially in the early part of the 20th century, for all of the anti-Catholicism in the Christian Reformed Church, a Christian Reformed Church still recognized a Roman Catholic baptism, which is kind of an interesting thing. And they'd recognize baptisms from any Trinitarian church. And so if you think about now, in any, just by virtue of when you live and where you live and a whole bunch of other issues, because attending a particular church kind of lands you in the middle of a very complex social matrix, which the more theologically educated you become, the more complex this is going to be. A lot of people just, you know, like the first time you went to a church, you asked your boss, and mm-hmm. your boss went to a church. So you went to church, the same church as your boss. You didn't have a theological matrix. You weren't paying attention to church fathers. I mean, you were reading the Gospels and, you know, Jesus, God, what's going on here? But you were just sort of engaging them. And I don't think that sort of, when I use the word naive now, I don't mean it in a pejorative sense. I mean it just that you only know what you know. And even though now you obviously have accumulated a lot more theological and philosophical understanding, you still only know what you know. I mean, we always only know what we know. We're human beings. So then suddenly, the more theological knowledge that you get, the more all along the way, part of the learning of this theology and philosophy is sort of an appropriation. Now you've got opinions. You've got opinions. You know what? A Zwinglian approach to the Lord's Supper is, and compare that to, let's say, a more of a Calvinist real presence, or a Lutheran, or a Roman Catholic, you have all that knowledge now, but yet, right, given where and when you live, your church options are going to be limited by time and space, and also limited by, well, now you're married, and so you're going to want to participate in a church with your husband. So now you've got his theological and philosophical opinions mixed in too. So there's going to be a lot of compromise along the way. I don't think it is disingenuous to hold your personal theological beliefs in a degree of tension with the church that you are participating in. And the reason I say that is, if you can only participate in a church that perfectly aligns with all of your theological ideas, you will never participate in a church. And there is something, the more theologically educated you get, in many ways, the bigger a problem this is going to be. And and I think in some ways, this is where I think C.S. Lewis's approach to mere Christianity was vital for his own participation and his own spiritual growth as an Anglican. And you'll find Lewis regularly complaining about his church. And we can imagine this, because he didn't like the music. He didn't like the songs. I would imagine he often didn't like the preaching, because here's this guy who, you know, is absolutely brilliant, knows all this stuff, is better educated than the preacher, can run circles around everything that's going on. But here's the spiritual danger. He's full of himself. And so submitting to a church, a situation that for you've got all kinds of questions, you've got all kinds of opinions, but yet at some point you don't want these ideas and opinions to become idolatrous. You don't, in other words, want to create this perfect image of a church in your mind that really only exists in your mind. So I appreciate the spot that you're in. And I actually, you know, so part of what happened with this channel was, of course, I started making videos and people started coming to me, and usually not publicly too often, but they started complaining about their church options. And then sometimes people would, I got to be really careful about what I'm going to say about this. Then sometimes people would come and they would say, watch the live stream at Living Stones. Or they come and visit and they're like, boy, I've listened to hours and hours and hours of Paul. But then when I go to his church, what were they expecting? That the church would be a reflection of, that Living Stones would be the Paul Vanderclay show. No, it is not. I don't pick the music. I submit to my elders. And in fact, in many ways, in terms of the local church, I want the people at this church to use their spiritual gifts to shape this church, and to not have this church be a tyrannical reflection of my ideas. I've already got tremendous influence on the church, obviously, because I'm preaching in it. But the church does not belong to me. It belongs to Christ and his body. And so at a certain point, I have to submit to that body with all of the, do I really like that song? Do I really like what this person is doing over here? Do I really agree with what's going over there? And as a local church, you know, I just shut up about that stuff. And I do it now, after years of doing it, I do it joyfully, because what brings me more joy is seeing the body of believers worshiping and serving their God. Sometimes, you know, I don't always agree. I don't always think it's the best, but they're offering their best to the Lord. And I will encourage them to do that. And I will not make the church a reflection of me. So now you're not in that same position, but at some point you're going to have to figure out that. See, the difficulty is, and I meet a lot of Christians who they're really smart. They're better educated, maybe, than the pastor. They've got a whole lot of reasons why, and their arguments are good and right, and they got a lot of good points. This church is doing it badly. But what church does is, it's our devotion to it is a reflection of our submission to Christ. And
right,
that is healthy spiritually for us, because what it actually does is opens us up. Because I, you know, what tends to happen, this is so true of pastors, especially when they retire, because they become critics. They sit there in church and they're just critics of everything that happens. And you can't worship when you're criticizing, because, and at some point you have to say, you have to shut off the critic and say, God has called me to love these people. And what love always means is, and you know this now that you're married, you know, well, you're in your first year. I mean, you've just started finding fault with your husband. Trust me, it'll continue. And he will continue to find fault with you. But what you do in a marriage is you learn to love. Even, you know, I joke with my wife now, because things that I used to find annoying, I now sort of, not all of them, I sort of find them adorable. Because they're expressions of her. And what happens over time is that love changes that. And so there are things here in my own church that sometimes I see them and part of me wants to roll my eyes. Another part of me finds it adorable, because that's living stones. It's not me. So this is part of a journey of spiritual maturity that you're on. And now hopefully you'll have some options in terms of what you can pick from, because it doesn't mean, you know, just like in a marriage, it doesn't mean you just have to constantly live with no. No, there's negotiation involved. You'll get a chance to exert your influence, but it always has to be done in love. Because the primary thing to keep in mind is the church doesn't belong to you. It belongs to Christ. And, and well, I show my Protestant Reformed nature here when I say, in many ways, that's an expression of his people. And I think that there's some theological differences there with some of the other traditions, but I don't know. I don't know if that answer is helpful at all.
Oh, yes, definitely. Thank you. Yes, I heard you say before, like, that people went to your church and then they were kind of disillusioned, maybe, or at least surprised. And then I always kind of had to think, well, I when I first went to a church, I went to a church like your church, and it was a small church, and I loved it. because the people, I could actually get to know the people and they got to know me.
Yeah.
And I think that part of why the reason why I have a struggle with going to church now is that church is just too big, and it's and it's a family church, so there are a lot of people who are very busy. And I'm a student, and they know I'm a student, and I sometimes feel, and this maybe is projection, but I've also heard other people say this, that if they know you're a student, they don't build up a relationship because they know you're going to go away again in a few years, and there's always new students coming in.
Yep.
And that just was such a big difference with the church that I had left behind.
Yeah.
That I felt I had to take a step back because I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And then I'm now at that point where I think, okay, well, should I start re-engaging? But then in what way? Because I don't really feel like I have a place there. And actually my husband had a very similar experience. He was much more active than I was. He really genuinely tried, but then, and it's not that it's a bad church. I mean, there are a lot of people in the church that I really appreciate and I think are deeply spiritual, and they do make it into a church of God. But then I struggle with how do I adjust, how do I submit in a way that it's not just going through the motions, but that I'm actually just, that I'm also actually a part of the body.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And I think, and there will also probably be seasons in your life where, I mean, cause and now if your husband is going to be a pastor, then you're going to have a whole nother set of issues, because a pastor's wife is also sort of always, often, not always, kind of alienated from the church too, because it's hard. And if the church is small, much less so, but you're sort of, if you're the pastor's wife, you're sort of the first lady. And so there are privileges and opportunities for that, but there are also problems with that. So there are no perfect marriages. There are no perfect churches. There are no perfect relationships in churches. And sometimes, just as you described, I'm so glad you had a good experience earlier in a church. And I often recommend to people to find a small church for exactly that reason. And most people don't. Most, at least in America, the majority of Christians go to large churches. But I generally think that's a mistake. A small church has so much more opportunity, even though, yeah, the program isn't going to be great and the music might not be great, and there'll be a whole lot of things not great about it. But what is great about it is it's, especially someone coming from the kind of story that you had, where your parents broke up. And I mean, it sounded like at that point in your life, you really needed a family, and that's what a small church can be.
Yes. Yes, I really experienced that, and it was really transforming, because I had not thought that that was possible. Like, also just having the example of people staying in a marriage.
Yeah.
And it's not like my parents divorced again, but that pattern was just really apparently graved in deep in my psyche, that that is just what people do.
Yeah.
And then there are these people that sometimes fight, but then they make up again. And then, okay, so that is also how things can go.
Yes.
And I'm still so thankful that I had that other example, because I didn't have that previously. And it's not like I grew up without loving people, because my parents, they are very loving people, and they had their faults. But then again, I also have my faults. But yes, the church, it does really make a difference.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah.
No, that's very true. Well, I hope. So I would say, yeah, in terms of you might have some theological differences with the church, but I think it's when you participate in the Lord's Supper, when you partake of the Eucharist, you are partaking, I'm going to reveal some of my Protestantism here, but you're partaking in the Eucharist of the church. It's Christ, it's the Lord's Supper. It's Christ's body and blood. And it's doesn't belong to the local church. It belongs to Christ. And so it might be coming to you through that local church, and there might be issues, theological issues locally that you disagree with, but it's Christ is coming to you through that body. Just like in many ways, Christ came to you through that small church, and he came to you and he showed you what marriage could be and what, I mean, Christ comes to us through the church and through other people. And that's how he, you know, that's how he ministers to us and through others. So yeah, there might very well be issues, but as long as it's Christ's church, that's okay. You know, I think about, I don't know how much, you know, Sam on the Discord community, and he's in the comment sections a lot under Sam Adams. You know, he's a Unitarian, so he doesn't believe in the Trinity, but he's kind of an evangelical Unitarian. And so my conversations with him that are on my channel, you know, he really struggles with, he goes to Trinitarian churches, and, you know, and then finally when they find out he's a Unitarian, oh gosh, what to do with Sam? And Sam's got to figure out what to do with the church. And, you know, yeah, what, I love Sam to give up his cause and become a Trinitarian, of course. But, you know, we live in this world with all kinds of things like that. And so, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. And I hope we get to share this video, because a lot of people struggle with this. And I talk to a lot of people privately who struggle with this. And, you know, and I deal, as a local church pastor, I deal with it all the time, because people come and go, or they come for a while and they're like, no, pastor, I really need a different church. And I bless them because I understand. And it's hard though. I mean, it's hard if you're a small church. You know that I haven't been in a small church, because every time some new person comes, it's a big deal and everyone comes around them. And so when they go, it's like, oh, they're leaving. It's like losing a member of the family.
Yes, I can't imagine why you would leave a small church, but of course everyone has their reasons. And I can imagine that those people, well, they had their reasons, but it just seems like such a blessing if you have a tight community in which everyone knows you, and like, you know, who's playing the organ, and you know, who is, I don't know, singing badly, but you know, they have other qualities. And
exactly.
It really is like a big extended family in a way.
Yeah, it is.
And I kind of miss that now, but then again, I think maybe if I think year that I was studying, I was really struggling with this, and it was keeping me awake, maybe even at night. And then at some point I just thought, I have to sit this out and wait until I move again, because it's not going to happen here during my studies. And I think recently, also through engaging with Orthodox theology, I think the question started being introduced again, because I feel like I can't be a Christian on my own. And of course, I'm with my husband, and he's facing the same struggle that I am, of not really fitting in and struggling to find his place. Also, of course, because he is studying to become a pastor. So there's always this this distance between us and the community, in a sense. And how do you do that as a pastor? Like, is it just a matter of keeping your prayer life healthy and reading, or do you have like friends that are not part of the congregation but do help you spiritually, or what's it like for you?
All of the above. pastoring can be kind of a lonely thing because, just as you said, you're part of the church, but sort of not a part of the church. Again, in a small church here, it's a little bit easier. I've been here, let's see, it'll be 24 years this August. And so it is very much a family, and I dearly love these people, and they love me. And so that's a huge part of it. Spiritually, it's just as you described, it's your prayer life, it's friendships, it's and I've always derived a lot of different people take spiritual sustenance in different ways. So previous pastor here, who was a friend of mine, he was retired. He just passed away this last year. Would often do retreats. And so I've known pastors who are big on retreats, and they can't go 6 months without taking a week away just as a spiritual retreat. For me, I derive a lot of spiritual benefit from the kinds of things I do with my channel. And I like thinking about ideas and reading books, and I love studying the Bible. For me, I'm fortunate in that my sermon prep, a lot of pastors will warn other pastors, about sermon prep, because that can cut both ways. And I find it different with different pastors. But for me, I find my sermon preparation very spiritually satisfying and filling. I would find it now, I'm a third generation minister, and so I got to watch my father go through various stages too, even though I didn't know I was watching him. But I'm probably going to be like my father in that I find it spiritually very satisfying to minister. And so whether it's relating to people, maybe it's the Freddie and Paul show, it's my relationship with people at the church, it's sermon preparation, I find that all very, very satisfying. But different ministers are different. And I've known some who have been in the job 20, 30 years, and they need to get out of it just to have their spiritual lives restored. So it varies tremendously. But yeah, it is, being a minister can be hard on one's relationship with Jesus for some, but not always for others. It's very individual. And you and your husband probably won't know this until you start getting into it and learning and figuring out how to do it. I've often found having friends outside the church is important. And for me also, we have a close colleague group of another colleague and I collaborated very early on here in planting a lot of other CRC churches. And then, so we have this group of local ministers who are colleagues that are also very helpful. But everything you just described, and I think for everyone piecing it together, suiting to taste is important.
That's good to know. Thank you. Yes. Well, my husband, I mustn't forget to pass on his appreciation of what you do online. And of course, I also very much appreciate the community that you're sustaining. And he's listened to a lot of your conversations, and he's learned a lot also for his own pastoral experience, just how to engage with the next generation, let's say. Yeah. For example, I do a lot of things for my university regarding the education program. And he said, well, maybe you should start thinking about how do you engage the community online, kind of like what you're doing, because this is something we're not trained in right now in seminary, but this is probably a growing medium for pastoring and spiritual engagement. And I think it's he's right and we should pay attention to it. But then again, there's also a bit of a resistance inside of me that says, no, people should just go to a community because and look who's talking, because I mostly get my stuff online as well, but then it just won't compare to worship.
Yeah. It's too early for this. What's happening right now, what I'm doing, what others are doing, it's too early to really generate a lot of wisdom. We're still in the trial phase. We haven't learned from our failures yet. We haven't had enough big catastrophic failures yet to know that's a bad path. Don't do that. And so we're sort of guinea pigs. We're test pilots right now. But you're right. It's going to be unavoidable. And we have no idea the formations and malformations and opportunities that these new media will offer. And so it's very, very early days. You know, again, in some ways, it's sort of akin to, you know, the Protestant Reformation. I mean, Columbus discovered America 1492, Luther, Wittenberg-Dorf 1517. You know, I'd never put those two dates together, but, you know, in a book I read recently, it was like, yeah, that world was changing fast.
Yes, and it hasn't stopped.
Hasn't stopped. And ours is too. So, yeah, these are all good questions. And online is going to be an aspect of many churches, but you're right. There's nothing. A local relationship is vital. And in lots of different ways, you can ghost online so easily. Mm-hmm. You can do it locally, but it's harder. And the betrayal is more obvious.
Right. Yes. And then again, I must say that what I've had online by listening to sermons, to lectures, it has given me so much more, I think maybe I should say, understanding of God, and also I hesitate to say spiritual growth, because I do think that is something you do through prayer. Although reading theology can sometimes also be mental prayer. It is good theology, really does bring God close.
Yeah.
And it is such an amazing time in which we live. Like, you have so much information at your fingertips. It's almost hard to decide what to engage with and what not to engage with. Because I really engaged a lot with Jordan Peterson, and I still appreciate a lot of what he does, but it's radically different from how you engage with Orthodox theology and the Church Fathers, and how you engage with people like Calvin and Luther, which I think are the Reformed Church Fathers, if I may.
That's who they are.
Yeah, or I should say the Protestant.
The
terminology is a bit different. But and how do you, if you're not actually educated in things like that, how do you even begin to decide what is true? I mean, that is also often something that people are looking for, like, but what actually is the truth? And I mean, I really deeply admire the people that are going through questions like that right now, because it's very difficult to grapple with these kinds of things.
Oh, it is. It is. And you're right. I too have. So I'm a bit dyslexic, which means that, I mean, I can read, but reading for me is a little slower than listening. And
for me as well.
Yeah. And yes. So very early on, once MP3s were out there on the internet, I was downloading sermons and downloading talks. And I, you know, would I wasn't really adept at YouTube until Jordan Peterson. And then suddenly I get up to speed on YouTube. And now, of course, with smartphones, it's and audiobooks, it's just exploding. But you're right. Our challenges now are very much in, you know, relevance realization, which book to mm-hmm. read, where to put my time. Because, you know, I've got a Kindle library of 1,000 books. I've got a physical library of, you know, many more books. I've got an Audible library of a couple hundred books. YouTube, new content comes out all the time. So a lot of it is, okay, how, it can't all be the latest video, the latest conversation that puts you in the silo of the now. Church fathers are nice because that broadens you to older conversations. You know, reformational church fathers, you know, there you've got kind of a critical hinge in terms of the world we're living in right now, especially, mm-hmm. you know, a seminary in Compton, which has its own history. Mm-hmm. And I don't know a lot of it, but I know, you know, little entails of it from my own Dutch Reformed education. So, you know, you've got lights like Bovink and Kuyper who are out there in the Reformed tradition, mm-hmm. who are sort of, you know, peak of modernity, trying to sort things out. And no, it's now, you know, I think it's tremendously, I'm always an optimist, but, you know, the fact that, you know, Orthodoxy is coming online. Here's a whole treasure of Christian wisdom that for the most part, the West, you know, didn't avail itself of. And mm-hmm. probably what we'll be seeing in the next couple of hundred years is much more integration of the church fathers into the Western tradition, you know, with all of, because Orthodoxy didn't go through, you know, the Protestant Catholic division and then into modernity. But, you know, someone like Jonathan Peugeot, he's Orthodox, but he's also a person with a zip code who was born. He's at least, you know, 10 years younger than I am. So all of those layers come to the fore, and Orthodoxy will also be changed, even though it's a tradition.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
That is actually quite a big topic right now within the Orthodox Church. So for the last year, I've studied with the Orthodox. And that has really changed also my idea about the Orthodox Church and Orthodox theology as a whole, because you cannot know Orthodoxy through Jonathan Peugeot.
Right.
And it is, I absolutely admire what he does, and he doesn't say things that are heretical or anything, but Orthodoxy just goes so much deeper. And it's actually, people are not going to like me for saying this, but it's not that different from Protestantism. And I was so surprised to find out, and of course it's different because they are liturgical and they do think differently about certain dogmas, but really there are so much similarities. I had never expected that. And I'm currently trying to see if maybe it's possible to see if there's some kind of meeting point, a point of contact between the traditions, but that's difficult. But someone like, for example, Father John Beer, he is an Orthodox priest, and he's written quite a lot of books that are widely appreciated by both the Protestant and the Orthodox tradition. And he's one of the people who can do that in a very genuine manner. It's not critical at all. He's also been one of my teachers, so I was very fortunate to study under him. But I think it would be great if there were more people that were would try that, because I think both traditions would benefit from that. And I think it's possible, at least. I don't think they can merge, at least not yet, like become one. I don't even know if we should want that, but it's not an antithesis between Orthodoxy and Protestantism per se, especially with the church fathers, I think.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. I agree with you too that the questions of, let's say, structure, ecclesiastical structure and unity are very interesting questions. And of course, Protestants have sort of majored in trying to figure out a lot of those things because we've been so fractious that what tends to happen is that, well, then you wind up, okay, I was in this church for a while, then I was in this church, then I was in this church. And how are they the same church? And all those questions, like we started with, okay, you're participating in communion with this local communion. What does that mean? Where is Christ? How does Christ work through these traditions, these individual believers, the specific church? These are all good, challenging questions. So we have about 5 more minutes. And so I usually give like a 5-minute warning in case that there's, there's something that you wanted to get to, but we haven't gotten to yet.
Oh, well, I think that's what we've discussed so far has already helped quite a bit. The thing you said about being part of the community and that the community, although it may not entirely align with what you think, you can still be a part of it. I think for me, the biggest struggle with that was more a matter of conscience. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Thank you.
I hate the English of the Dutch. Blows me away. I can't speak a lick of Dutch, and my parents could, but not me.
Yeah. So, because I, on the one hand, I was thinking, well, I should have a clean conscience if I participate in the church, and it will be if I don't have that, I will be disingenuous, and that's not fair towards the church, because the church also has a bit of authority, and I do want to submit to that authority. So how far should I take that? But it does it is a bit of a relief to me that it doesn't have to be perfect. At least maybe that was where I was maybe asking a bit too much of myself and of the church.
Yeah. And probably, you know, if your husband does take a church, and then you're not going to have a lot of choice, because there's limited options that are calling him. And I mean, cause that's a whole nother layer to this. Often again, develop a good group of friends. I think about my mother. You know, she has some lifelong friends from, you know, the church in Patterson that my father spent 36 years in, and in all of the churches. And so friendships can in some ways be like tiny little churches, especially if for a variety of other reasons your relationship with the church is complicated by employment, by necessities of various sorts. So, but if you don't make perfect the enemy of the good. And I'm sure you've got plenty of, I mean, the Dutch have such wonderful proverbs, so I'm sure you have a good proverb for that.
I don't doubt it. I can't think of one right now, but definitely.
For those who don't know the Dutch, you know, that's like my friend John van Donk and Job, you know, all these Dutch sayings, and too bad, you know, I grew up in Patterson and not in a real thick CRC community. I don't have as much Dutch as others, even of my generation. So that's the way it goes.
Yeah, it must be a unique position to be so acquainted with the Dutch culture, but then live in America, because I can imagine that the two are quite different.
Yeah.
The Dutch I always think of the Dutch as a bit, it's a bit like the Hobbits are, like the Shire.
Yep.
Because it's so very homely and but also a little bit crass sometimes. And but yeah. There's so much freedom in this country. I often forget just how free we are, and it's not for nothing that so many theologians came to the Netherlands, and that's so deeply ingrained in our culture.
Yes.
And yes, it's a unique place to be.
It is. It's wonderful. Well, I'm so glad, Sarah, that you persevered and got a rando slot. I know it's hard, but I do keep them open, and not all the video surface. So I will send this video to you, and you can watch it with your husband. And if you give me the thumbs up, I'd be happy to share it on my channel. So
thank you so much for the opportunity, and thank you for keeping open these rando slots, because I think that's a real is really helpful for the people. Thank you.
All right. Well, take care, and God bless you both.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.